Welcome to the Inside the Boards podcast, the podcast dedicated to helping you learn to think like a question writer so you can study smarter, not harder, and succeed in medical school. And now here's your host, Patrick Beeman.
All right, so we're back again with another segment discussing finances for medical students with Dr. Ned Palmer, who is a real-life doctor. An actual doctor and an actual chief strategy officer for Panacea Financial, who is generously supporting our series on health system science. Today's question is financial literacy. What's the point? What do students gain from financial literacy?
Thank you very much, Patrick. It's great to be back here at Inside the Boards. Always such a pleasure to be sponsoring the your health system science material and curriculum.
I know there's like too many S's. tell us about financial literacy. Make us financially literate. How about that?
Absolutely. So
in two minutes,
I think we can cover all of financial literacy. So financial literacy matters at every stage, and the earlier that we as providers, as med students, residents, fellows, and attendings, the earlier you can start to learn about some of the core topics in financial literacy, the better off you'll be through the course of your life as you go on making financial decisions. As a med student, 80% of med students made the incredibly expensive decision to take out $200,000 on average of student loans to fund their education. That is a massive amount of debt. It is manageable by understanding some basic tenets, gathering some of the core concepts of financial literacy, understanding things like interest rate, term rate, finance, refinance. But it is a huge ask that too often we see physicians just put into a corner and ignore that $200,000 until it's become $300, $320, $340. It grows, and without attention and without understanding what the best methods are, you leave yourself liable to be living paycheck to paycheck, even as an attendant.
Absolutely. I mean, like sometimes I'll be like go into like a clinic or the labor and delivery floor, and I'll be, you know, like they're ordering something, for instance, like DoorDash, and I have this like compelling sense that maybe I should like pay for something, but then you know, and I often do, and I think everyone should be generous if you're able to be. That's, you know, the point of having money is to do good with it. But if you are making $250,000, that's an awesome income. If you have $400,000 in student loan debt at the same time, your like net revenue each month, if you think about yourself as a business, is not really that great. I mean, you'll do fine. You got great cash flow, but you know, you can't work for 3 months and you forgot to get disability insurance. You know, there's tons of things that make our financial state as physicians and medical students, number one, not understood by the general public nowadays, I would say. And two, there's still hardship. There's still difficulties. I mean, probably everyone listening to this right now understands there are financial difficulties with becoming a doctor.
Absolutely. And so if we could throw some numbers behind that, Patrick, just some of the ones that you threw out. So if you're making, if you've got a salary of $250,000 a year, your take home every month is in the neighborhood of about $20,000. That's a great amount of money. You know, that's great. That's really comfortable. That's really healthy. Okay. We're going to strip off conservatively 50% to taxes. To your paying for health insurance for you, for your family. And so we're down to about $10,000 that you've got of in the pocket money. Still great. $10,000 at any point in my life would be terrific. But I, Dr. Ned Palmer, I owe $412,000 in student loan debt at currently 7% interest rate. On a 10-year plan, I owe $4,700 every single month.
Oh man, that sucks. Now you're only down to like $5,000 take home.
Now I'm down to $5,000 take home, which is great. That's a lot better than the $3,500 I had in residency.
Totally.
But it's only a little bit better than what I had in residency.
Well, then you got rent or mortgage.
renter a mortgage, car insurance.
And you're not in Ohio like me, right?
Sadly, I'm in Boston. So I think my I'm not getting the cost per square footage boost that you are.
Man, this is depressing, dude.
Yeah. And so I'm sorry. I didn't mean to bring the sads to the HSS series, but the...
No, it's okay. It's your sadness more than mine. So it's easier for me to have that detachment. But that's why you started Panacea, right? Like, this is the whole impetus.
To address this, absolutely, because it's too easy it's too easy for a physician to work hard, do good work, and still end up living paycheck to paycheck, struggling to make ends meet. And yet they're making so much money, they don't qualify for any kind of assistance. They certainly don't get a lot of sympathy. It's too easy. And so financial literacy in this case affords you an understanding of how you should be restructuring your finances and helps you look for opportunities to make your financial health better. And that's where the literacy piece is really important. You don't need to go out and get an advanced degree in personal finance to do this. There are just some core concepts that you can be mindful of as consumers, which will really add to your financial health.
Yeah. And there's a lot there to list. So eventually we plan to do a little series on financial literacy. At least I either thought that in my head or we talked about it briefly, but maybe we'll leave this in here and not cut it. So we're committed.
I'm about it. The more education, the better. Okay. We educate everybody.
Perfect.
A smarter group of med students is better for the world.
Amen to that. But all right. Well, here's the plug. Discover the difference with a bank that's built specifically for you and your life. Just go to panaceafinancial.com/ITB to get started. Panacea Financial is banking built for doctors by doctors. Panacea Financial, a division of Sona Bank, member FDIC. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Inside the Boards podcast. I'm Patrick Beeman, the usual host and founder of this platform, or at least one of them. I'm here today with Mustafa Shakir, who's are you a third-year medical student?
Second year, almost finishing second year.
Okay, 2.5. And Dr. Tanya Fancher, who is the Associate Dean for Workforce Innovation and Community Engagement, and the Interim Associate Dean for Student Resident Student and Resident Diversity at UC Davis, if that's still an interim position.
That is, yeah, true for 20 more days.
20 more days, okay.
Just about.
I'll let you guys say a little bit more about yourself, and we'll start with Mustafa, actually, because he's the most important person here as a medical student talking to other medical students. We wouldn't have a future without you guys. So Mustafa, what are you into? What are what's your background?
I appreciate it, Dr. Beeman. Thank you so much. My name is Mustafa Shakir, as you mentioned. I got into UC Davis about a year ago. I'm a second year medical student now. We just finished our half of our fourth block. So we're approaching step pretty soon. My background, I'm originally from the Middle East, from Iraq specifically. I came here when I was 16 and I attended community college and then Santa Barbara for undergrad, UC Santa Barbara. And then I took about a year and a half of a gap year. I did some work in the laboratory, in a clinical lab, and I did some research work. And then I finally applied into UC Davis and I got into the program, which was an honor. And honestly, one of the best things that has ever happened to me, hands down, for sure.
That's awesome. Dr. Fancher, you are a former U.S. Air Force physician, correct?
Correct.
I was too. So thank you for your service. But also, you double majored in classics and biology, right?
I did. You have done your research. Yes, I did.
Well, I took a couple. I studied Latin and Greek as much as I could in my philosophy undergrad. That's what I did, and then a master's program. And the whole time, even now a little bit, I wish I had actually majored in classics. So you still read any Latin?
No, not like I used to. And I have to say, one of the most memorable classes was taking Greek in college. And to me, it's about history, right? And stories and really understanding the origin of things, I just think is fascinating. I think that we get stuck in ourselves or in contemporary and realize that things are much deeper, our history is much deeper than that. So,
yeah, I think it was G.K. Chesterton who said that history is the democracy of the dead. So I've always appreciated that phrase.
Nice.
All right, today we're here to talk about kind of the social determinants of health. And thank you to the AMA and Elsevier for giving us some support for this series on health system science, the third pillar of medical education. You guys came aboard, gave your time to discussing these social determinants, which are identified as five in the HSS textbook that is published by Elsevier that we'll put the link to in the show notes. So we're talking about things like one, economic stability, educational level of the patient's health, community, neighborhood, kind of the things that provide the framework and context in which we see patients. And honestly, they're what, 90% more important in determining how one's biological health is than pretty much anything we can do in the context of a visit inside an exam room.
I think that's the most humbling part,
yeah.
Right? To think about, like, we're so used to seeing patients one-on-one in the hospital or in the clinic and realizing that the therapies that we can offer in that context are pretty limited and that we have to look outside if we're really concerned about care for our patients and the public.
Yeah. So, Mustafa, why are you interested in social determinants of healthcare? Because we're going to talk about a project that you guys collaborated on at UC Davis.
Yeah. I personally come from background in which I grew up in a relatively third world country that one was going through war and everything. And I think I noticed the impact of that on me personally, on some of the people that I know, my family, my friends. And I sort of took that and I imagine what it would be like if all of these other things had happened and how that would have affected me and my family and my friends, similarly to how growing up in those conditions affected me currently. And that really allowed me to sort of get a perspective of what it's like when I see a patient who tells me that I don't have enough resources to get food. I don't have enough resources to get the most basic necessities, because I feel like I can relate to that, because I had seen people like that, and there was a period of time that I felt something similar to that. So I think that sort of my background helped me really empathize with those patients and really recognize the importance of those social determinants of health.
Totally. I recently opened up a level one opioid treatment program where we help people with opioids, specifically substance use disorders, providing medication-assisted treatment with methadone and buprenorphine. And this is just, it's changed my entire outlook on what it means to be a doctor and in many respects, just in general, my own like personal values. And yesterday, kind of timely, I saw this patient who had enrolled in our program, which are very, very heavily regulated from both a federal and a state level, given the potential for diversion of medications like methadone or buprenorphine. So she had enrolled, dropped out because of transportation issues. Patients in these programs have to go to dose every day to get the medication at a window and be observed. And eventually they get some more privileges. But she came back after a month and a half and she just looked awful. Like she'd been through everything and like she had. You know, this is Cleveland, Ohio in December. And I was like, well, what's going on? And I'm tired. I slept in an alley last night. And I was just like thinking, oh man, this is my last patient. I'm going to go home to my house that has three HVAC, you know, furnaces. I've got, you know, two Oculus Quests. I live in this like luxury that is really worlds different than what, you know, she experiences day to day. And because of her own, substance use disorder, like she also has trouble getting the help just because she can't get to the clinic, or she could walk 4 miles a day to dose and then 4 miles back to the place or area she usually stays at. But right now she doesn't have anywhere to stay. And it's just, I can't stop thinking about it since yesterday. Even though I know this stuff happens all the time, it really struck me yesterday. I don't know, I'm just telling her story because she's a pretty cool person, deserves to have her story told, and I just wish we could do more to help people like her, which you guys try, I assume, to do in the student-run clinics that were the site of your project here.
So kind of like what you mentioned, the student-run clinics that we have about 12 of them, and we actually are having the 13th open up soon. Wow. Yeah, and they're really exciting. They're very exciting projects because they help the medical students get clinical experience, and they have to help the populations of the communities around us, because our student-run clinics serve mostly uninsured, undocumented, financially challenged people who would not be able to go get care anywhere else. And each of our student-run clinics is sort of catered to a specific population, and they serve a specific population, whether that is like population from a cultural standpoint, from a habits standpoint. So we have a clinic that's catered for the Hispanic population, a clinic that is catered for substance abuse population, a clinic that's catered for the homeless population. And of course, there's crosstalk and people can go to different clinics, but that sort of stratification allows for us to get people to work in those clinics that have very specific interests and have very specific backgrounds that helps with that kind of things. So for example, we have undergraduate students do translating in our clinics because a lot of our patients don't speak English. And so if you're a Hispanic undergraduate student who is interested, who knows Spanish very well, you can join the Hispanic Culture Center clinic. That way you are speaking the native language, and that helps the patients feels more familiar at the clinic.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Fancher, you are you in charge of setting these up, or do you help direct which sites open, or if they have a particular character like he describes, like more Spanish speaking population? Is that your role?
No, it's not my role, actually.
Okay. I'm just interested what an associate dean for workforce innovation, I want to know what that means, and the community engagement portion.
Yeah, so actually that Mustafa can tell you more, but the student-run clinics are really run by faculty in the community, Patrick, and it's the medical students that are providing the incredible infrastructure, but they're truly partnerships with the community. And I think to build on what Mustafa said, you know, we also think about the structural determinants of health in addition to the social determinants, and those have to do with policy and immigration, and even for your patient, right? What is the stigma and policies associated with trying to get treatment, right? Yep. The kind of treatment that she needs, and those aren't necessarily due to her built environment, right? They're really due to our national policies. And what I do is we're lucky at Davis, as Mustafa talked about, we have many different student-run clinics, but we also have programs within the medical school that help the students to pursue careers that they're committed to. And so in addition to the work Mustafa does, what I do is if students are interested in rural health, for example, I create opportunities for them to really immerse in rural health. We have an urban health program that we call Teach MS. We have a program for the San Joaquin Valley. We have a 3-year primary care program. And now we're starting a project that's, again, sort of place-based, and to recruit students from rural Northern California and Southern Oregon as a partnership with OHSU to populate that area with more physicians. So like Mustafa said, there's something really important about the background that you bring to this career in medicine. I think it offers an easier connection to patients who share that background. You know, we can teach you the knowledge that you need in medical school, right? But you bring an incredible experience and assets. So what we're doing is recruiting students that way to Davis. So that's, I'm lucky. That's the work I get to do.
Are you internal medicine or?
Yeah, I'm a general internist.
Okay, cool. Mustafa, so how, tell me about your project. Why did you guys start this project? And I'm just going to not say anything more about it and let you explain what you guys did.
Thank you. So this project started right around March when all the social distancing and quarantine, strict quarantine guidelines went into place. And like I had mentioned, our clinics provide care to people who don't have care anywhere else. And we have been providing this type of care for decades. Some of our clinics have been open since 1980. And so a lot of our communities depend on us and only on us to get care for a lot of chronic conditions that they have. And when March happened and everyone had shut down, that included our Sunderland clinics. We basically got a mandate from the AMA, from the school, from the city of Sacramento, that we cannot, as preclinical students, see patients on a volunteer basis in a Sunderland clinic. That was shocking at first because that, you know, to us, those clinics are life-saving to these populations. To other people, they're just clinics. To the patients, that is the only source of care that they can get. So we quickly sort of scrambled, and we had a bunch of meetings. Different clinics had a bunch of meetings, and we decided to move into a telemedicine model like most other practices around the country. And basically, we established, online systems and new protocols and things like that and how to transition our care to a telemedicine model. But then we noticed after a few weeks, there was a few problems with that, especially specifically when it comes to our clinics. One, like we had discussed, a lot of our patients don't have access to the right technology to do an effective telemedicine visit. That is, they either don't have access to video calling to actually, you know, make the visit viable. And some of them don't even have phones to actually make a telemedicine visit. Some of our patient population for like one of our clinics, Willow, serves the homeless population. They don't have phones, so that's practically impossible to do a telemedicine visit. So then with Willow being closed, that population lost all access to care. That was the number one problem that we noticed. And then the second problem that we noticed was because we are Sunderland clinics and we lack a lot of the resources that any other health systems have, such as like imaging access, other diagnostic test access, we rely more on the physical exam and the physical interaction with the patient to care for the patient than other providers potentially. The way I like to explain to people is, you know, if you go to a regular provider right now and the provider suspects something, they, instead of them making the decision right then and there, they end up sending you for an imaging because they have access to that. They have access to send you for an imaging for you to get images. For us, we really have to sort of look at our physical exam findings, really talk to the patient, get that history, and determine, can we proceed without imaging? And if we can, how does that look? And if we can't, how does that look? How can we help the patient get the care they need when we don't have a lot of resources at our hands?
For that first portion, how did you overcome the difficulties in access for people who, you know, didn't have the technological means?
Right. So from there, that's when we sort of, that's when we moved on to the next step of the project. Our next goal was, or the thought that became the main thought is, how do we get around those two problems? How do we get to see patients who don't have access to care or who need a physical evaluation while limiting the spread of COVID, keeping our patients safe and keeping our students safe? Because that's the main priorities, keeping everyone safe while still providing care. And from there, me and some of my colleagues, Josh Campista, Omar Escobedo, and Neha Manakar, we worked with some faculty and some medical directors from certain clinics to come up with a protocol, a safety protocol, and a workflow protocol of how we can overcome those exact two problems. Our three goals were to be able to see patients physically on some sort of capacity and develop a protocol that allows us to do it safely. And most importantly, have this sort of program protocol be sustainable for the future. Because this was back in April, and we knew this was going to go on for a while. This wasn't going to be something that's going to end in 2 months. So one of our main goals was to make sure this is something that we can carry on, that can last for a year. Because we don't want to provide care for 2 months and then be like, oops, we're sorry, we're done. Like things ended right there. So those were our main goals of the of this project, essentially. From that point on, we kind of looked into the CDC criteria, the WHO criteria. We worked with Dr. Fancher a lot. That's actually when Dr. Fancher and I met, was the first time through that committee, through that protocol. And to sort of summarize, we took about 5 months for us to develop everything. We decided that we were going to open one centralized clinic to see patients in person and have all the other 12 Sudermed clinics still operate on a telemedicine capacity and sort of send patients that they deem necessary to see physically to that centralized clinic for physical evaluation. And the idea there was basically having one centralized location would allow us to consolidate PPE, which was a very, very big issue when we started this, because PPE is so scarce, and we really need to provide adequate PPE for our students, for our faculty, to be able to see patients safely. And the second thing it allowed us to do is sort of consolidate the workforce, so have everyone from all Sudermed clinics help in that centralized location.
That makes sense.
And sort of have a better control over that one centralized location, because it's really hard to implement a safety protocol in 12 locations and make sure everyone is following it, compared to implementing a safety protocol in one location and making sure everyone is following it.
Dr. Fancher, what has been your role in setting this up and guiding the process?
So I was their primary contact at the School of Medicine. So what we were trying to figure out was, what are the policies at the health system? What are the policies in the clinics? How can we apply those now to the student-run clinic? And can we take advantage of some of the pathways that have existed already in the health system? While the student-run clinics really operate quite independently, actually. But so that's the work that I did with Mustafa. They developed, gosh, how big was your protocol? It's like a giant document of a protocol.
Yeah, I think it was like 14 pages or something.
Yeah, and so that's the piece that I helped them figure out, Patrick, was, Here's some ideas. Let's try to put it in this cohesive way. Let's make it so that it can be replicated at other clinics. Let's ensure that before any new students are invited to participate, let's ensure that there's a training program, right? So that they review the protocol, sort of all those pieces. So that while I think the students were really trying to figure out what's the best thing to do for our patients, like I have to make sure that the students are safe, right? And that they're accounted for too.
All right, cool. I guess what I'd want to go into now is Mustafa, how do you see what you're doing with these student-run clinics, or SRCs, I guess we can abbreviate, with these SRCs? Give me an example of how your work has addressed one of the, or a number of these social determinants of health specifically.
Yeah. So after we kind of came up with that protocol, we actually opened, our first day was opening for that centralized clinic was September 27th. And we've been seeing patients since then. And I continue to sort of oversee the weekly logistics just to make sure that things are running smoothly. And we're soon transitioning that operation to the incoming class as we sort of go into dedicated and they take over the student-run clinics. But essentially, for the first few days when we opened clinics, I made sure to be on site because I wanted to really, me and my colleagues that I had mentioned earlier, made sure to be on site to evaluate our work and make sure that there's no issues in our workflow that we had created and all of that. And I remember seeing a few patients then. I remember one time I saw a patient that had come to clinic and they had worked a lot with their hands and they had come to clinic complaining of hand pain. We diagnosed them with a cyst on their hand that was happening from overuse of their hands. And so one of our recommendations was, hey, take a little bit to rest, take some time off. And this person left and they came next week and I had been working the next weekend as well. And when they came back, they sort of approached me and they were like, hey, I really need a letter to get me off of work because my job requires me to work a lot with my hands and I really need a letter. And they almost sounded shy about it. And I, of course, like personally, I will give a letter. Like that was the recommendation that we had given, is to get time off and you're needing time off and you're needing recommendations, show that you need time off, we'll of course give that. And so I was like, yeah, sure. Like I'll write a letter. And this person just burst out crying in front of me. And I was like, whoa. And they were crying because they were so appreciative that I was so believing of them. And I was so just immediately willing to like believe them and give them this letter. And all I'm doing is I'm writing a letter. Like it's three sentences, right? It's a heading with three sentences that says, please give this person time off. But this person was so appreciative that they lost their composure and they just start crying in front of me. And that sort of really like moved me because I was like, wow, this person, like I'm doing something so simple, but for this person, this is such a big action because they have such a hard time getting access to care, getting physicians to believe them, getting all of these things. And sort of getting like I said, something as simple as a letter to get off of work, that me performing that little action so quickly made the world difference them that day. And so we had sent the patient home, and that honestly gave me a bigger even push to sort of like keep this clinic going, because this patient would not have been able to get all of that had it not been for us opening that clinic location.
Yeah, it's a simple example, but it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I try to emphasize often that medicine is not just applied biology. It's an art, and the art is long, life is short. Ars longa, vita brevis. That's for Dr. Fancher. But you have this person whose probably economic stability depends on their ability to maintain their job, and of course, in medicine, we are balancing often whatever the biological good is, or the board's answer for this or that condition, with real life and the fact that we have to be able to address things that will affect the ability to pursue what is the textbook answer for this or that treatment. The ability to retain a job is certainly one of those things. So hopefully the job was accommodating, because I've also been in situations where it's like, no matter what I do, these people are not going to help the patients with their own health. And it's annoying. Wish you had more power, as it were. But let's get a little more practical here. Let's dive into some cases. And these are not exactly board style. They come from the HSS review book published by Elsevier. And I would say I can go ahead and read this first one, Mustafa. Maybe you can read the next one, and then we can just kind of go through some of these answer choices and the issues surrounding them. So with this one, we've got a 31-year-old prima gravid patient who immigrated from Bhutan, who presents to the Women's Health Clinic for first prenatal care appointment. This is her third appointment at the clinic, but she had missed the first two. She's an immigrant to the United States from Nepal, where she came from a refugee camp 2 months prior and has had no prenatal care to date. So at 30 weeks, still no prenatal care. She speaks only Nepali, but is accompanied by her husband, who speaks a little bit of English, and an interpreter phone is used to conduct most of the interview. Her physical examination and lab testing reveals no issues regarding the pregnancy. So the first kind of question that we're asked to think about here is what are the social determinants of health that contribute to the patient's difficulty with keeping appointments? So what are they, Mustafa? This would be the easiest pimping question you ever got. The open-ended ones.
I think it's everything you had just mentioned, the lack of insurance, the lack of financial resources, the lack of culturally informed care, and the immigration status. And we actually, this is a classic case that we see in our student clinics, someone who doesn't speak English very well, someone who doesn't know much about medicine, who doesn't know about, who doesn't have access to insurance or healthcare resources, and who relies on us to really sort of address that part of their care and of their life.
So if this were the boards, and yes, again, the boards are going to have questions on health system science, or your school may eventually have a straight up health system science exam that you'll have to take. But if you're being asked what the social determinants of health are related to a case like this, you might have answer choices like A, lack of health insurance, B, limited financial resources, C, lack of what you mentioned, access to culturally informed care, or D, immigration experience and immigration status. So the answer here, what are the social determinants, are all of them. And that's why I mentioned that it's not quite a board's compliant question, because the NBME does not allow all of the above, none of the above type question constructions. But something to keep in mind for, you know, reading the vignettes, pulling out those different aspects. And the way we did that is perfect too, just as an aside. You know, Mustafa, if you're preparing for step one here in a few months, or even now, you know, having an idea of what the answer is to the interrogative or question being asked prior to actually looking at the answer choices, the so-called cover the answer choices test, that's the way to go when it comes to not only getting the single best answer scored correctly on your exam, but also like reducing your anxiety, because I mean, probably all of us have had that experience where you like read a question, you're like, I know what that is, and then you get it and see the answer choice on it and you're like, boom, I'm moving on. But if you're like struggling and thinking like, oh, is it A or B, and you're like weighing it back and forth in that whole test, you're like thinking, oh man, you get all this anxiety. So try that, cover the answers test.
I agree.
But all right.
Thank you.
Back to the subject at hand. So anything more to say about that case, Dr. Fancher?
Yeah, you know, I would just say, as we think about the importance of the immigration experience and immigration status, I just don't want that to go unrecognized. And I think the other thing I would want to think about in this case is asking her about violence, or either personal violence or witness violence or threats of violence, and ensure her personal safety and just not make that assumption in this context.
Yeah, intimate partner violence is, you know, a big deal when it comes to pregnant women for sure. And then if somebody who comes from a refugee camp and is an immigrant, I'm sure is a lot of potential for violence that someone like me just doesn't really, it's never on their radar. I don't know, Mustafa, if you can, or if you're able, comfortable to speak to that at all, if you want.
So this is actually a very difficult topic to address, and in the context of student-run clinics, mostly because talking to someone about something so intimate, so emotionally provoking is really hard for a physician, and it is especially hard for our medical students who are still training to be physicians. And I have been a witness of some multiple, actually, cases that came to our student-run clinics in which a patient didn't tell us offhand, and then the medical student had picked it up from basic questioning and didn't know what to do. And then most of the time at that point, we notify the preceptor. And luckily, we have amazing preceptors in student run clinics who are very well diversified and know how to handle these situations. And then at that point, the preceptor goes in with a medical student, cares for the patient, and the medical student learns on how to handle these really sensitive topics, which I think is a very big advantage in our student run clinics.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, just learning how to communicate surrounding these things is, you know, it's going to do worlds of good for your education and the patients you'll be responsible for in the future. For sure. Like, that is definitely an art that needs to be taught a lot more, is addressing things of that nature, addressing them well.
There's also, one of the clinics has a medical legal partnership, which brings in legal aid on site so that you can get assistance for your patients right there, and they'll help them even after the visit too.
Wow, that's awesome. Man, that's, I was also at another patient encounter yesterday where I was like, man, I wish we had some like legal aid, but one thing at a time. All right, so let's go on to the second part of this case here. So
Mustafa, I'll read it for you. How's that?
That sounds great. Thank you.
So RL is a 30-year-old woman. She's primarily Spanish-speaking and has a history of gestational diabetes. She presents to the weekend clinic for headaches. Her personal pronouns are she, her, and hers. She has a headache that is on both sides of her head, occurs most days, and improves with rest. She has no photophobia or change in vision. Her blood pressure is normal. She's married and has 3 young children. Her husband works in construction. The family eats fast food 3 nights a week because the kids are embarrassed to eat their free lunches at school. So when they get home, they're awfully hungry. And there's lots of fast food options at home. She also volunteers that she moved here when she got married, moved here from outside the country. So the question for you, Mustafa, is which of the following interventions are likely to help her? So A, prescribing her something for migraine headaches. B, referring her to a neurologist. C, asking her about food insecurity. D, all of the above. Or E, none of the above.
I would say I would ask her about her food insecurity, because the fact that her children are volunteering or qualifying for a free lunch in school, that gives me an idea that likely they have a struggle with food insecurity. And food insecurity is one of the biggest social determinants of health, and has a huge impact on your current health and your future health. And so addressing that would be intervention and prevention in my eyes. That would help intervene with any current problems that are going on that could be addressing, causing her headaches, and prevent any future problems that could happen from poor diet.
Yeah, this is really great, because I think this could go totally differently and probably does most of the time in real life. If you have a patient like this, okay, I'm OB, by the way, comes in, it's like, okay, she's got headaches, so what pill can I give her? Or does she have features for which I need to refer her to a neurologist? And if those are the only two things that you're thinking about, then you've missed a lot, because, I mean, with gestational diabetes and this potential issue related to her nutritional status, she might be having headaches because she's not eating enough, eating the wrong things, et cetera. Thoughts on that, either of you?
Yes, I totally agree. And we actually have a lot of our patients like that. And luckily, we use a lot of local and national resources to help with that. And we have in a lot of our clinics what we call education departments. And they are small departments run within our clinics in which undergraduates and medical students collaborate to teach patients that come to our clinics about diet, about exercise, about long-term care. And more importantly, give them access and knowledge, some of those resources that they could use, that they have at their disposal, to address issues like food insecurity, mental health issues, and stuff like that.
Yeah, perfect. And then Dr. Fancher, you said you wanted to do 2 questions, because we could end it here, or Mustafa, you could stick around, or we could just keep going.
I have until 1 p.m., so Nothing scheduled. I finished finals. I am good with school for at least a week.
Awesome. Good for you. Well, then I would say then let's keep going. We can cover the rest of these that are here, just kind of quick and dirty, as they say, because this will be more like pearls you should remember regarding the social determinants of healthcare. Again, thanks to Elsevier for providing this content. So these are straight up questions. With the next one, it's known and well documented health disparities in America include which of the following? A, life expectancy disparity among races, infant mortality disparity amongst races, diabetes prevalence by gender, race, education, socioeconomic class, food deserts, that I've always thought one extra S can lead to a bunch of different problems with the word dessert and desert. At any rate, food deserts preventing access to healthy food for the poor, or all of the above. So this one's all of the above. Just to highlight here that, you know, life expectancy, infant mortality, diabetes prevalence, these are all well-documented health disparities amongst races, and diabetes also with respect to gender, education, socioeconomic class, and then the lack of healthy food accessibility for the poor among us. So next, though, is more of a appropriate case.
And just to say, I think something that's really exciting and just emerging in the data in the past couple of years is that looking at racial concordance for physicians and patients, we're seeing that patients, yes, I think patients are happier, but we're seeing that patients actually live longer and get better treatment. So there was a study that had come out of Oakland that was black male physicians taking care of black male patients, and that they got better care and were more engaged in their care. And that we just learned this year that when black infants are cared for by black physicians, they also do better.
Interesting.
So for me, it's an important part of the solution to this problem, right? From a workforce side, that really we need to do a better job at recruiting students like Mustafa, right, to care for communities.
Yeah, I guess those of us who serve the communities should, you know, be reflective of the communities which we're serving. That seems kind of intuitive, but I think we have not done that great of a job in medicine, although probably getting better with people like yourself, assuming roles that will help encourage that diversity. And that's really surprising, though, too. I don't know, to discuss that a little more, what do you think that says about the, or what is the likely reason for that? You have black physicians taking care of African-American babies doing better. Why?
It's such, I don't think we know, right? Because it's not access.
That's kind of a leading question.
Yeah. It's not access. It's not education. It's not sort of the traditional, it's not socioeconomics, right? The pieces that we have historically thought about. But I would guess that there's something that happens on both sides that is something that's unmeasurable right now, right? About having to develop this intense trust in a stranger very quickly. And I would think at a molecular level, honestly, there's probably something that happens, right? So when you're not, when you're stressed or not trusting, these changes happen. And hopefully those are happening less when you're having less of that stress in that initial encounter. So that's what I hope is happening. And I think that, you know, we need lots of doctors and lots and all kinds of different doctors. And I think that we benefit from each other. I just am so proud of the renewed insistence and attention on the importance of workforce diversity to really try to fix some of these longstanding problems.
So you're saying these findings are a result of a certain je ne sais quoi about the concordance of race and probably other less measurable factors in terms of meeting out delivering care. So,
yeah, I mean, if you look at the Oakland study, that, you know, those doctors spent a lot more time with the patients. They knew the patients' social history better, right? So the patients, they would spend more time talking about their outside of the office celebrations, right? Family milestones, family challenges, things like that. So that the relationship is so different. So we as physicians, like, you know, you even said, we often think about what's the med that's needed or what's the referral that's needed, right? But the art of this job is much more complicated than that.
Should be asking what's the relationship that's needed, probably. Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's do another one here. Case number four, you want to read this one, Mustafa?
Yeah, sure. Case number four. Bridget is a second-year medical student who's doing an away rotation at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. During her rotation, she is asked to develop an initiative focused on one of the five key areas identified by Healthy People 2020. She decides to focus her proposal on developing an after-school program for elementary-age children, which aims to reduce gang-related violence. Which of the five key areas of Healthy People 2020 is the main focus of Bridget's project? A, economic stability. B, education. C, social and community context. D, health and healthcare. And E, neighborhood and built environment.
And these are really kind of that, kind of the five main social determinants identified as part of this framework in health system science. And so for this one, it's neighborhood and built environment. I know that because I have the answer. but let's explore that a little more. Why neighborhood and built environment? What does that even really mean practically? Maybe that's a question for Dr. Fancher to put her on the spot here.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, a big piece of this question to me is related to safety, right? Mm-hmm. And safety in the neighborhood, be it lighting, things like that, right? Sort of safety. But I also think about the things related to ACEs. So for early childhood exposure and really exposure to gang violence is one piece of that. And so sort of thinking beyond, sorry, Patrick, going off on a tangent on your question, but
no, that's okay.
Just to apply it to sort of this real life context, right? That we know that that these exposures to children have lasting impacts on their health for years and years and years to come. So the more that we can do at that level, I think, is pretty critical. It leads to lots of other questions in my mind about what's the history that led to that in that environment, right? That sort of led to set up the neighborhood to be a place that is subject to gang violence. I think that's not necessarily true of all places. So it just brings back that issue of redlining or sort of structural determinants in addition to the social determinants.
Yeah, you said lighting, and in a literal sense, I thought mm-hmm. actually that lighting could actually be part of the neighborhood and built environment. Of course, that makes tons of sense. If you know the streets are dark and you know, like, nefarious things can happen under the cover of darkness a lot easier, throw up some street lights, perhaps that reduces the incidence of violence or theft, mm-hmm. Things that can put somebody, injure them economically. I don't know, is that true? Do you know, or?
Do I know the data? I don't know the data. It certainly makes sense to me.
Yeah, just offhand, I don't know.
No, I don't know the data offhand. It certainly makes sense to me. But I think we'd also have to think about poverty and employment, right?
Oh, yeah.
Totally. Housing that's fair priced for the neighborhood, things like that.
Yeah.
And actually, sorry, Just to comment on that a little bit, Dr. Fincher had mentioned ACEs, and I think that's getting a lot more recognition, which I think is really important. Addressing.
And you're talking about adverse childhood events.
Yes, adverse childhood experiences. Yes, because that's getting a lot more recognition in the sense that addressing that early on could really help prevent a lot of the chronic diseases that we're seeing now that are some of the world-leading causes of death and mortality. I think that's getting a lot more attention. Unfortunately, I don't think that's, I don't think from like health system perspective that is getting a lot covered yet, because like in California here, children are covered by Medi-Cal for insurance, for healthcare. But for example, that doesn't cover addressing ACEs, which is clearly, as I was mentioning, is getting a lot of attention now, and how that could save cost in the future if you sort of address that early on. And part of our initiative to sort of address that is we have some students from the school, some undergrads from the UC Davis campus and some faculty are working currently together to put on that 13th Sunderland clinic that I had mentioned, which will actually be catered for the pediatric population. And we will work with states, resources and providers around the area to not only address medical care for pediatric populations that lack access to it, but to also address a lot of these ACEs in a free manner for these vulnerable populations. So these students in that clinic will be targeting zip codes that are well known through multiple studies to be financially challenged, to have a lot of crime and violence. And they will physically go by a mobile clinic to those neighborhoods and try to address medical care and ACEs and follow up with these children and adolescents into the future, which will hopefully improve their healthcare outcomes.
Perfect. I think we can close here, but I just want to close with the kind of last question we had looked at, and that was, what percent of determinants of population health is attributable to medical care? And just to drive home this point, the answer to this is 10%. So when you break down the determinants of population health into, you know, a pie chart of behavior, the genetics, the social circumstances, the environment, environmental exposures, and healthcare in general, the portion that can be attributed to medical care, probably what we do when we close the door to an exam room, that's 10%. So I think a lot of us have seen that with COVID and its widespread effects on some of these other things, especially the social circumstances and environmental things. But yeah, I appreciate your time. You're welcome to come back anytime, either of you. And, you know, keep doing what you're doing. It sounds like you got a good thing going, both in terms of educating the students at those SRCs and taking care, more importantly, of the patients that you serve.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you, Dr. Beeman. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
Absolutely.